From SDPB Radio, I'm Josh Heyer, and you're listening to the In the Moment News Podcast. Each week, In the Moment with Lori Walsh brings you news and arts coverage from across the state. Listen live at 11 a.m. Central, 10 Mountain on SDPB Radio, or tell your smart speaker, play SDPB. You can find every In the Moment segment at listen.sdpb.org or subscribe to the In the Moment Segments Podcast. And now, it's your weekly roundup in news coverage. On Friday, U.S. Senator John Thune came back to the program for a conversation with In the Moment host Lori Walsh. Enjoy.
Senator Thune, thanks for being here.
Thanks, Lori. Nice to be with you.
I want to start with just the numbers. It feels like it would be wrong to start anywhere else without talking about, you know, the numbers in South Dakota being 21 people now who have died. As we look at these big picture, you know, programs, and we look at the economy, and we look at what back to normal might look like, those are individual lives. That has to weigh heavily on you, as it does on me right now, when you just look at the numbers continue to go up.
Yeah, it does. There's no question about it. And, you know, that's the first job, is to protect life. And obviously, many of the steps that are being taken to deal with the health emergency are designed to prevent the spread and keep fewer people from getting the virus, and therefore hopefully from being hospitalized and ultimately, you know, dying from it. So it's very sobering. And when you put it in that perspective, it's a grim reality, but it's why it's so important that we continue to apply these practices and these guidelines that are designed to keep people safe.
Yeah, and it seems as if we've had doctors on this program say we're doing a better job at the length of time that people are in the hospital. We're doing a better job of understanding how that supportive care works, or doing a better job of figuring out what kind of social distancing is effective. But there's still no treatment for this. There's still no vaccine. There's still no cure. And it's still an incredibly contagious, contagious virus. I do want to talk... Go ahead.
Yeah. Go ahead. No, I was just going to say, you're absolutely right. And the until we have some of those therapies and until we have a vaccine, this is going to, you know, we're going to have to continue to just be circumspect and very careful and apply a lot of these physical distancing type and physical separation type strategies to keep people safe.
When you look across the country and you take calls during town halls or as people contact your office, are you noticing a restlessness for people who want things to be, in quotations, normal? And how do you respond to people from a leadership perspective to say, now is not the time to take your eye off the ball?
I think one thing you have to do, Lori, is you have to figure out how to get people to sort of recalibrate their expectations, because I think people have this expectation that all we do is flip a switch coming out of this and everything goes back to normal. And that's not the way it's going to happen. I mean, this is going to be a slow climb out. There will be benchmarks along the way, I think, that will make people more comfortable and give people more confidence to get back out there. But it's going to be a gradual thing. And I hope that, you know, the availability of more testing would be one issue, a curve that's not only flattened, but hopefully starting to bend downward would be, one of those benchmarks that you could look at. Hopefully the arrival of an antiviral therapeutic, this one that Gilead came up with, supposedly reduces recovery time by about 31%. There are some others out there that we think are going to be more effective. So at least people have the confidence that if they get it, they're not going to die from it. And ultimately, as you said, you know, it's the vaccine, but that's quite a ways off yet. In the meantime, we have to figure out how to get people sort of back out there, but in a way that doesn't create even more problems by allowing this thing to catch fire again. And everybody's talking about a second wave in the fall. But I think we have to get to where we have an acceptable level of risk. And how that's defined is probably going to be slightly different for each individual person. If you're a young person, it's probably very different than somebody that's over 65 or has a pre-existing health condition. But I think we have to be smart about this. Political leaders have to be smart. The health community experts have to be smart in terms of how they advise people. But it's not going to be something where we flip a switch and overnight everything's back to normal. It's going to take a while.
It was always about protecting those vulnerable people, and in some ways it seems like that's being forgotten a little bit, that was, when we first started this, that was top of mind.
Yeah, it needs to be. Like I said, the first priority in all of this is to protect lives. And so, you know, there are people who are obviously more susceptible to, based on their age and you know, underlying health conditions, to this virus in the first place. And as Dr. Fauci has said, this is a pathogen that wants to infect 40% of the American people. I mean, it is very viral once it gets out there. And I think the key is to create the safeguards, put the guardrails around the way people interact with each other so that it limits its spread. But we have to be particularly careful with those more vulnerable populations, because as we've discovered, you pointed out, I think, in your lead-in, that you get more information, more experience on hospitalizations, what works, what doesn't work. As more data comes in, we have more real-life experience. We're operating less on assumptions and more on real-world experience. And anytime you can bring real-world experience to bear, I think it really informs and makes your decision-making a lot better. And hopefully that the more data we have, the more information we have, the more experience we have, the better we will become at figuring out what works and what doesn't work and how to sort of slowly get things opened up again, but in a way that protects the health and safety of people.
Let's talk about some of those efforts. And this week was round two of Payroll Protection Program. More money flowing into that program and more people trying to access it, which means more challenges with just the vast quantity of people who are applying. What can you tell us about that second wave of funding and how that is going?
Well, it's up and running again, and I'll tell you, you know, that was long overdue news for a lot of small businesses. Very welcome, I think. As you know, we pointed out in the past, there were some hiccups in getting applications submitted into the SBA, what they call the E-Tran system, which is the portal that they use for, you know, processing these loans. But I think the SBA leaders are addressing that. The important thing here is the program's finally functional again. As of Wednesday, approximately $90 billion of the PPP loans were approved for another almost million small businesses through that additional $310 billion that we had added to the original amount. So when this started, it was a $350 billion program. That got burned through real fast. The additional allocation is $310 billion. Of that, already $90 billion has been used up. So that's a lot of loans going out there. As I've mentioned before, South Dakotans have taken full advantage of it. In the first iteration of this, the first $350 billion, South Dakota got, I think we had about $1.4 billion in loans, and there were over 11,000 businesses that took advantage of it, which put us in overall at about fifth in the nation in terms of, you know, the number of, proportionally at least, the number of businesses that were able to get access to it. So it's been successful, and it's one of those things I think we just have to continue to pay attention to, because it is providing bridge financing. It's cash flow, it's liquidity for these businesses to keep people employed for the next 8 weeks, at which time we hope that we'll be in a better position and they'll be able to, again, things will start slowly transitioning and they can get to where they're actually operating and functioning again. But as of right now, it's been a very successful program. It's been heavily subscribed and a lot of dollars have been put out there on the street that are hopefully making a difference.
So help me understand, you know, the definition of success, because if we've spent nearly $70 billion to keep people employed, but we have 30 million people filing for unemployment, those numbers in South Dakota went up again this week with people filing for unemployment. Put those two numbers together for me and talk to me about measuring the success of that.
Well, I think that those two concepts are designed to complement each other. We knew that there are, you know, some people who, some businesses probably that are not going to, you know, maybe not going to make it and or are laying off people. And those people who are being laid off or furloughed are those that are eligible for unemployment insurance. And that program was made a very big, robust program so that people who, for no fault of their own, ended up having to go onto the unemployment insurance program have a very good benefit. And it's, again, a four-month-long program. But the idea behind PPP was to minimize that number. So, yes, the numbers are big, that people who are going into under the unemployment lines. You know, I talk to people who are being furloughed and laid off, and that's the option that's available to them. But our hope is, at least through PPP, that that number is a lot smaller than it otherwise would be. And I think that's how you have to measure that in relative terms. If you've got in South Dakota, like I said, prior to this most recent infusion of new dollars, we had over 11,000 businesses in South Dakota who had used the PPP program. Hopefully that means that a lot of those employees and workers are, you know, continue to be employed, continue to get health care benefits, retirement benefits, all the things that PPP was designed to cover. If those who don't, who aren't making it, end up having to apply for unemployment, and there are some weird, you know, interactions and folks who, for whatever reasons, I've talked to people like, for example, stylists, and they are, they weren't forced to shut down. And because they weren't forced to shut down, they don't qualify for unemployment insurance. If they're shut down involuntarily, then they have to, then they're eligible for unemployment insurance. And yet they're also having a hard time, you know, getting PPP funding, and many of them are self-employed. And so there are lots of those types of people who sort of fall through the cracks, and trying to anticipate those problems and try and fix them and help as many people as possible is what these programs were designed to work. So unemployment insurance should complement PPP, but clearly there are going to be increases in numbers in people who are applying for unemployment insurance.
If we hadn't had some of the hiccups that we had early on with small business owners being able to get those loans, if we hadn't had some of those larger businesses taking up some of that funding, some of whom have given that funding back, for example, would we have had fewer people on unemployment if that had been a smoother rollout? What I'm wondering specifically is if some of these people got laid off because there was, you know, a several week delay in sort of getting that payroll support that business leaders needed.
Yeah, I think that's probably partly true. I don't think there's any question that when there are delays in the program and there are businesses that have applied or are trying to get approved and the program shuts down, or people are using the program that shouldn't be using it. I mean, when, you know, the Los Angeles Laker basketball team decides to use the PPP program, that's probably something that's, you know, abusing a government program. That clearly is not something that a franchise that's worth $4.4 billion needs to do. And the Treasury Secretary, Steve Mnuchin, has said that they are going to be auditing these programs and seeing, making sure that there are, you know, some of these people who are applying. There are some major media organizations I've seen that are very successful that have applied for it. So there are lots of entities out there that, for whom this probably was not designed, and who have the capacity and the liquidity and the cash flow not to need it. But, you know, the design of the program was such that it was trying to cover as many businesses as possible, as much payroll as possible, and as many employees as possible. I do think it's unfortunate that we lapsed for almost 2 weeks waiting for the Democrats and Republicans to be able to agree, because I think that probably cost some people that otherwise might have gotten loans and might have stayed employed and ended up having to apply for unemployment insurance. It didn't need to take as long as it did, and that's unfortunate. But hopefully now that it's up and operating again, we'll get more people applying.
You mentioned people like hairstylists or other people in business who haven't had the customer base and have had to lay people off or shut down if they couldn't get a PPP loan, but they couldn't qualify for unemployment insurance because they were technically open. Now we're looking here in South Dakota. I'm sure you know about Governor Kristi Noem's, you know, back to normal plan, and business owners, restaurant owners, lots of people are scrambling to try to figure out what does this look like in the days ahead, because there was never a clear guidance to shut. There was never a mandate, I should say, to shut things down. Now there's this guidance to get people back to work and get things open. but we still haven't even reached our peak in South Dakota. Talk a little bit to South Dakotans about how to navigate that, because you know the funding for the PPP, if you get it, is 8 weeks, and that's not that long. I mean, that's not permanent. Plus, your customer base is going to drop significantly, and you have to maybe invest in some alterations in the way you do business, or you have to at least reduce the number of people in your facility. There's a lot going on for business leaders and employees to really sort through right now.
Yeah, and those are really hard decisions. And I guess the idea was to try and make that easier and hopefully get the worst of this behind us, so that when they do start to open up again, albeit in a probably more limited fashion, that at least they can get through it. And but you know, my guess is going to be a lot of innovation, a lot of creativity, and business models and how businesses operate, and you know, creating, particularly restaurants. You know, right now many of them are carry out, but if they do open up again, there's going to have to be some physical spacing that allows for social distancing and things like that. So I think it's going to require a lot of innovation and creativity as things start to open up again. But you know, again, I think that what hopefully coming out of this, a lot of these businesses that are, as they and a good example of this would be a tourism business in Western South Dakota. The one thing that the Treasury did just this last week, and many of us were pressing on them to get them to do this, was they're very seasonal. So when they got a PPP loan, for example, they get it now. They don't have that many employees, but a month from now they'll be fully employed. And so when they apply for a loan and they take, this is what our payroll cost is today, well, it doesn't even come close to covering. So what the Treasury did is they allowed flexibility for a seasonal business like those in the Black Hills to be able to list on their payroll the amount that they would have when they're fully operating and functioning, and like, for example, in the middle of July as opposed to the middle of April. And so they're trying, I think, to be flexible to allow these businesses that are going to get hard hit, we know, coming out of this even, some flexibility to try and get a little bit of relief on liquidity and cash flow help, et cetera. So I think the idea is to try and maintain as much flexibility as possible. But from a business standpoint, in a state like South Dakota, which never really shut down in the first place, what does it look like and what does it mean to open up again, I think is a question that's probably going to get answered on almost a case-by-case basis, depending on where you are in the state, what the experience is, what the metrics are. Hopefully, if, again, you've got a flattened curve or a downward trajectory on your curve, and you can, you know, slowly open things up again, but do it in a way that continues to observe the guidelines that have, I think, done a very good job of keeping this from spreading as much as it could have here in South Dakota. So it's a tough call. Lori, I think a lot of these businesses are just faced with really, really hard decisions, and we want to keep them in business. We want to keep the workers employed, and like you said, not have them going into the unemployment lines. But at the same time, realizing that the business may not look today or you know, 8 weeks from now like it did 8 weeks prior.
Yeah. I've worked plenty of retail. I've worked in a few restaurants. I'm a very bad waitress, by the way. But and I've also worked in tourism in a museum. And gosh, you know, I can't even, how do you social distance in a kitchen? I mean, I see how you could do it in your dining room with your customers, but those kitchens are tight in a retail setting for the employees who are doing everything from stocking shelves to standing behind the cash register. And certainly in the visitor industry, when those visitors come, it's shoulder to shoulder. It's going to be very, very hard. Talk a little bit, if you would, Senator Thune, about the 4th of July and this conversation about fireworks at Mount Rushmore, and just what are some of the responsible ways to have that conversation moving forward, because there's a lot of anxiety about that in the state right now.
There is, no question about it. And like you, I've worked in a lot of tourism business. We grew up in it. You know, I grew up in Myrtle, and so two of my brothers worked at filling stations. My other brother worked at the Pioneer Auto Museum, which is our big attraction, and then my sister waited tables and I cooked. And you're right. I mean, in a kitchen, it's pretty hard to create the kind of physical distance. You're standing close by to your fellow cooks and dishwashers and everybody else, and so that creates challenges and, you know, creating some physical separation, obviously sanitizing everything, and we become much more aware and conscious, I think, of how important it is to disinfect everything on a regular basis. So there'll be a lot of, I think there'll be good guides and recommendations for how businesses like that could look and operate, but certainly going to be challenging, especially in the travel industry. But with respect to Mount Rushmore on the 4th, I mean, it seems to me at least that if that moves forward, it sounds like it will, that depending on what happens over the course of the next several weeks, there'll have to be some decisions made about, again, spacing. I've been in that amphitheater. It's a wonderful place to observe the 4th of July. Back when they used to have fireworks out there, it was a pretty extraordinary experience to be there and to see the fireworks in front of the faces. But my guess is if confidence is back and people are traveling, and there's going to be a lot of pent-up demand for people to go places, at least we've got some space out there. Normally in the middle of the tourism season, it gets very crowded. But I just think they'll have to be very careful and circumspect and cautious about number of people allowed in, spacing, all those sorts of things, realizing that there's no perfect way to do it. But I think people themselves are much more aware, much more conscious of that, are going to be taking precautions on their own, keeping themselves probably to their own families. And I think the park is going to have to look long and hard at how they create the sort of physical separation and to be able to pull this off. You know, it's hard to feature a scenario where we're completely back to normal by the 4th of July, and you could conduct that in a way that you would have 10 years ago. It's unlikely that happens. So I think there's going to have to be, again, guidance given for an event like that by the CDC, and hopefully that the state can partner with and make sure that if it comes off, it comes off in a safe way.
So on March 13th, Rodney Bordeaux, president of the Rosebud Sioux Tribe, issued an emergency declaration due to the COVID-19 virus. At the time, he expressed concern that his tribe did not have access to the CDC-approved test kits. His concerns extended to the tribe's elders and vulnerable members, as he stated the state had not made tests available to them. On Thursday, we invited Rodney Bordeaux onto the program for a discussion. Enjoy.
Chairman Bordeaux, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, good morning, Lori.
It's nice to have you. Let's talk a little bit about how things have been going from a preparedness stage. How have you felt throughout this so far? What are some of the challenges?
Well, we started to get some test kits to the state of South Dakota. IHS has stepped up quite a bit. We've developed a task force of tribal members, tribal health employees, and working with the Indian Health Service. So things have gotten better since my March 13th declaration. We're getting about 70 test kits a week, sometimes depending on what the state gets. But it comes to the IHS. And initially, when we started out, we were sending the test kits up to the state lab, and now we had a new machine from Abbott Laboratories, and we were able to get some testing done within 45 minutes. So it stepped up pretty good, but we really still need to, we still kind of have an emergency declared, basically to protect our people. We wanted to make sure that, you know, since we have a vulnerable population health-wise, whether it's diabetes, lung disease, heart disease, poverty area that we have, limited resources in terms of, healthcare systems. We have to still fly out people to Rapid City and Sioux Falls hospitals for urgent healthcare needs. So we're still in a vulnerable state, but we seem to be prepared enough to, take on some additional testing. We're doing some tracing, that type of stuff. So it's gotten a little better, but we're still in that emergency stage.
Tell me a little bit about the education efforts, because so much of preventing the spread of this virus comes down to really understanding how it spreads and making those kinds of changes. Tell us how you've gotten that word out and what some of the response from people has been about what they understand and what they need more of.
Well, we've worked along with the Indian Health Service and following a lot of the CDC guidelines. We've been doing weekly shows, PSAs. We have a channel 93, which is a local cable station. We have our Rosebud IT department. It has a YouTube channel. And we have two radio stations, KOIA and KINI. And we send announcements out there. They're broadcast daily. And then we do a weekly show. Today we're going to do our fifth one with the Indian Health Service. And we do give updates. And we also have a Q&A at the end. So it's probably an hour and a half show on our local radio stations. So the public is well informed in terms of what we want to do. We have a curfew that we have that's effective from 10 p.m. at night to 6 a.m. in the morning. The business is closed at 8 p.m. every day, 6 to 8. So they are cooperating, but we're still having issues with social distancing. People wearing masks, you know, it's getting a little better, but we have to be better with that, especially in several of our grocery stores here on the reservation. So it's been a lot better, but we still have to remain vigilant. We still have to be cautious. We're limiting social gatherings. So we just have to keep it up. And our tribal citizens need to be aware. And most of them are doing real good, staying at home, watching themselves. But we have a few that are, you know, just like the rest of the state, you know, just driving all over the area, and we just got to watch that. Our community health representative program, if we have a suspected a case, you know, they go out into the communities. If we have someone coming back from Sioux Falls, we're usually informed by some of the relatives, so we try to jump on that as soon as possible to get those individuals tested and interviewed as to where they came from and if they have any testing done from where they came from, especially if they come from Sioux Falls. You know, that's our hotspot from the state, statewide. So we seem to be pretty effective, but just staying on top of it is really important.
Right. Tell me a little bit about the economic impact of some of those restrictions and people staying home and on businesses. What has that looked like? And unemployment, what are you seeing?
Well, the unemployment is still high. We always say from 70 to 80% unemployment. With our tribal employees, we have essential employees here. The ones that are not essential, they're still getting paid. Our business, Rosewood Casino, they've been closed since middle of March, and they're continuing to stay closed. But it's starting to have some impact in regard to our tax base. We're going to see the real impacts here within this month. So people are shopping local, which is helping our local businesses, our local grocery stores, but we still have to go into off the reservation. Like some people are still going to Pier, Rapid City, but we're trying to have them stay out of Sioux Falls. So the local areas like Winter or Valentine, Nebraska, you know, people are going there to get their groceries. So the, you know, travel task workforce is still getting paid. The governmental employees are still getting paid. So we're lucky so far, but we've always had a high unemployment rate. So it's still, we're in an economically deprived area in terms of employment opportunities. So it's still the same.
So as we watch, you know, I think 28,000 people in the state of South Dakota have filed for unemployment since the pandemic began. There have been extra federal money, I think $600 a week more for people on unemployment due to the pandemic. There's been just a lot of attention paid to what the ramifications and the impact of unemployment can be. And I'm wondering how that looks to you as a president of a tribe where there is 70 to 80% unemployment going into the pandemic. Do you think people fully understand the impact that has on your community when everyone is sort of scrambling to help all these newly unemployed people? What are some connections and lessons we can learn from our concerns about what's happening in unemployment now and how we've handled it as a nation?
Well, I think make sure that those who are unemployed, I think right now most of the businesses are still operating on our reservation except for our casino. We know we've got to shut down, but we've had enough savings, and it's going to be stretching pretty thin here in the next 2 weeks where we're going to have to apply for some of this aid. Our Rosebud Economic Development Corporation, our economic development arm of the tribe, they've applied for the business loans through the PPE program. And our casino, along with other casinos in the state of South Dakota, Deadwood or the video lottery businesses, they became eligible just last week for the PPE program, which is a paycheck protection program, and they've filed their application, but we haven't heard back. So we're taking advantage as much as we can of these care programs, the federal legislation. And as it gets into May and if it goes into the summer, we are eligible for other funding that the state and local governments are getting. The tribal governments are also receiving some aid. So if we have to do some feeding programs and showing up some of those assistance to our tribal members out there who are also already been suffering, we will be able to be in a better position because of the federal funding. So we're really grateful for a congressional delegation, Representative Dusty Johnson, Senator Thune, Senator Rounds, and even Governor Noem for, you know, we had to play that lobbying game with the federal government, and they've been very supportive in meeting our needs that we put forward there, especially with the PPE program, you know, especially for our local businesses on the reservation, that hopefully those businesses have applied. But our congressional delegation and our governor have been very, very supportive of our needs down here. And without them, you know, I wouldn't have seen the support we got from the federal government. So we're extremely grateful for that. But we also need to be vigilant and be proactive, not only with the state government, but also the federal government. So we're really keeping our eye open and really getting involved with our lobbying efforts on the state and local level, or state and federal level. We've had calls with the Speaker of the House and some of our South Dakota legislators, and it's been effective, you know, just getting the word out and keeping connected with the state. So it seems to be a little better. But moving forward, we don't know what's going to happen in the next coming months. I know the governor's going to lift some restrictions on the population, but we're going to keep ours pretty tight because we need to. We're going to keep our curfews going. We're going to keep educating our people about, you know, maintaining social distancing, wearing face masks. We're going to step that up. We have some local vendors making cloth face masks for our people. So we're still going to be doing that and, you know, urging our people to stay at home as much as possible, because if it hits the economically deprived areas such as Indian reservations, we have health care disparities. And you see in the cities, the minority populations have been hit exceptionally hard in terms of casualties to this virus. So we need to really be careful here. So we're going to be going forward and maintaining our restrictions. We haven't done any border checkpoints yet, but we're going to have some discussions with our tribal council. And if it comes to that, we're going to be ready for that.
Mm-hmm. Would that change significantly if the casino was able to reopen? Would that change how many people were coming on, coming into the area from places that you really couldn't control?
Yeah, especially the tourists that are going through, you know, we kind of like to keep them going through, you know, if they're using Highway 18, U.S. Highway 18 or U.S. Highway 83, you know, those, especially U.S. Highway 83, that's a Northwest-South Corridor, and we'd like to keep those visitors, keep moving on through, because we don't know where they're coming from. We have to watch some of our local areas, our local lakes, and to make sure that we don't have outside visitors staying too long, because we don't know if they're infected or not. So we need to really protect our vulnerable population here. So we have the curfew, you know, that helps out a lot. But, you know, we need to make sure that people are moving through. We're not stopping them but they just make sure they're going on through. If they're going to the Black Hills or wherever, North Dakota, Minnesota, you know, a lot of them use U.S. Highway 83. Just make sure they keep moving, and we're not disrupting any travel for businesses or commercial, anything like that yet. So, and we won't stop the commercial traffic. No, that has to happen.
Where, if you had positive cases, where are they reported through Todd County? Are they reported through the state? Is there, like, how does the reporting work for testing?
Well, our primary one is the Indian Health Service. But we also have Horizon Healthcare, and then there's Avira Health in Winter. And we do get contacted through them. The state usually works with us as well, so we're monitoring them. But the primary source of our contact is Indian Health Service.
And then those are reported to the state. Like when we go,
pardon?
Yeah. What I'm wondering, President Bardo, is if when we go in the COVID.SD.gov and we pull up, you know, where cases have been reported, we just see counties. So are those being tracked on that website? Is what I'm wondering. Okay.
Yeah, they are.
And you haven't had? Have you had any?
We just had one positive so far, and we're lucky, but. What we're worried about is the spread, the community spread, you know, especially we have tribal citizens that live in Sioux Falls and coming out of there, you know, back and forth. We just got to watch them. And we had, there's an individual that had passed on, but he lived in Sioux Falls and he got it up there. So his services were yesterday. But see, that's counted as a Minnehaha County casualty. And so far, we've been safe so far.
So on Monday, the federal government's payroll protection program launched its second round, and Governor Kristi Noem had been calling for federal assistance to prevent the bottoming out of state budgets. So we invited on Congressman Dusty Johnson for a conversation. He came to the program to talk about this and the overall response to the pandemic disruption. Enjoy.
Congressman Johnson, welcome. Thank you for being here.
Oh, you bet. Man, there's a lot going on, isn't there?
There certainly is, and a lot of it feels pretty bleak from where we're sitting. So let's take a look at the Payroll Protection Program round two first, because that's something a lot of South Dakota business owners have participated in successfully. Others have felt a closed door. What happens next with that starting today?
Yeah, I think it has been a pretty substantial success. Now, of course, it isn't perfect. But that's not normally how we measure governmental programs, right? We understand there's lots of waste, fraud, and abuse in Social Security. And while we work overtime to try to reduce that waste, fraud, and abuse, we also acknowledge that, wow, Social Security, critically important lifeline for millions of Americans. The same is true for the Paycheck Protection Program. 74% of those loans went to the smallest category of American businesses, including, as you alluded to, Lori, 11,000 South Dakota businesses that got more than $1.5 billion. That is really having an impact on keeping 30 million Americans employed who otherwise wouldn't be. So last week on Thursday, I was out in D.C. with my colleagues. We voted to put another $310 billion into that program. And so, as you mentioned, today it is back up for business. In South Dakota, of course, there were people who were left on the outside looking in, but not as many as you might think. 80% of the eligible payroll in this state was approved under the first round of funding.
That first round of funding ran out of money in, I think, something like 13 days nationwide. And Seth Tupper here at SDPB did a story about really, you know, South Dakotans fared pretty well in that overall effort. But I'm wondering what your advice is to small business owners now. Is this a time to urgently get on this payroll protection program and apply now because there's limited funds again?
Yes, it was. And in general, whether you were a small business or a large business, if you called your lender in the first few days of the last phase, you got in and you were processed, with little delay. Of course, there were some problems with some people, but by and large, the people who acted quickly were successful. That's going to be the case with this phase as well. There's just no reason to wait. I mean, call your local lender, whether it's somebody you've just had a checking account with or somebody you have received a loan from in the past, you got to give them a call. I think this money's going to stick around for a little while, but there's no reason to delay. And we do want to make sure that people have an opportunity to bring their employees back to work, even if they don't have work for them to do. We would rather they maintain that critically important connection. That employee-employer connection is pretty special. It's how 180 million Americans get their health insurance, for example. We don't want that severed because, Lori, that is one thing that made the 2008-2009 recession so much worse. It took us a decade to build back up that labor force participation.
Right. So keep people at work. The unemployment rolls have also surged, and some people are taking that unemployment assistance, insurance assistance as well. But I want to talk, Congressman Johnson, a little bit about, you have experience in state government, and you hear Governor Kristi Noem talking about the state budget and some of the challenges that are looming. She really wants that federal assistance to have some flexibility to, refill the revenues. Talk us through that a little bit so listeners understand what the urgency is, and then why are we hearing from people like Mitch McConnell and others in Congress that this is something that there's not a lot of appetite for?
Yeah, this, South Dakota was provided $1.25 billion in the CARES Act. That's a lot of money. And the language in the CARES Act was pretty restrictive. It said that states can only use them, in essence, for hard COVID-19 costs. Now, South Dakota will have millions of dollars of those kinds of costs, but they're not going to have $1.25 billion. We will have vast loss of revenue directly related to COVID-19. I mean, I don't know what the numbers will ultimately end up being, Lori, but, it's going to be, 15, 25, 30%. Who knows how much our sales tax revenue is going to be off. And in a state where half of our general fund, more than half, is spent on education and Medicaid, there's limited ability to make 30% cuts if your revenue dries up. And so Kristi Noem is saying, and I agree with her, that states should be given additional flexibility, and that if the federal government's provided them $1.25 billion, the state should determine what is the best way to allocate those funds. The real hang up in D.C. is that there are a number of folks who think some states, looking at you, Illinois, who have been mismanaged, and they don't want this to be a federal bailout of non-COVID-19 deficiencies. I think we can get it done. I think we should provide states additional flexibility, but I think if they've been hurt by COVID-19, either on the expense or revenue side, they should be able to use those COVID-19 dollars. We can get that done in a way that is, I think, can restrict states from just bailing themselves out for errors that were made 2 or 5 or 10 years ago.
And one of the challenges that I was reading about this morning, and I'm curious if you agree with this or disagree with it, because I'm kind of puzzling over it myself, was this notion that the federal government wants these states to reopen. South Dakota never closed in the way that some states closed. There were specific restrictions, and there were vast changes, and certainly many, many businesses closed. But we didn't have a statewide mandatory shutdown. So whereas some states are thinking about reopening, in quotation marks, it looks a lot like what South Dakota was always doing. So do you think that there's something behind that, that they're trying to get an economy back in the right direction, and what lessons can be learned from South Dakota to say, this is what it looks like here, and it certainly doesn't look like a robust economy with lots of sales tax receipts flowing in. We are open for business in a lot of places.
Yeah, I do think that states coming back and rolling back previous decisions could end up looking a lot differently than South Dakota does today, though. I mean, you know, I didn't travel a lot because, you know, we're not supposed to be doing that. But I mean, I was called back to D.C. a couple of times to do votes. I mean, I see what the District of Columbia, which is under a stay-at-home order, looks like. And it wasn't really any different, not in any material way, from South Dakota. I mean, South Dakotans had really, you know, sheltered in place. I mean, there was, in Mitchell, there was no church I'm aware of that was having in-person services. When I went to go pick up takeout food from, you know, our local Mexican restaurant, there was nobody sitting there having a meal in the restaurant. We were doing a lot of walking, are doing a lot of walking and biking as a family. But when we see people out and about, they're not congregated together. I mean, I think South Dakotans, their compliance on these best practices has been remarkable. And I don't think it's been deficient in substantial ways from what I saw in D.C., for example. But as states begin to phase back, Lori, there's a danger that maybe that people will overreact. They'll think, oh, okay, it's fine now. Wait, now we can go back to the way it was. That's not what President Trump has said. That's not what Dr. Fauci has said. That's not what the blueprint released by the White House has said. It is a series of phases. And I think we want to be careful as we work. We all want to get back to normal. But as we work toward that goal, we can't just say, flip the switch, we're all back to normal. The president's made it clear there are a series of guidelines and gateways, numerical, data-based gateways that states should pass before they open back up, and that will be a phasing reopening. Let's try not to get that wrong.
Right. Let's talk about pork producers, because that is an urgent situation. We have not heard anything, as far as I'm aware of today, about the Smithfield processing plant reopening in spite of guidance from the CDC. I read through that report. There was a lot in there, but there was nothing that seemed to me to be particularly prohibitive of reopening the plant. Tell us where we are with that process and what needs to happen next. And then let's talk about what do pork producers need right now in order to make some of these difficult decisions about the days ahead?
Yeah, there is a lot there. I mean, I'll start on the producer side. I talk to these folks every day, and they're just devastated. I mean, the emotional weight of these decisions they're making are really getting to them, Lori. I mean, obviously it's a financial deal, but they talk more about the emotional strain, just having to depopulate these herds that they have spent so much time to build up and field such a stewardship over and such a pride in helping to feed the world. When all of that effort instead goes to not feeding the world, that is really hard for people. And, you know, government's pretty good at cutting checks, but no check is going to erase that kind of trauma that they felt last week and are going to be feeling this week. So that's hard. And we need to as quickly as we safely can, we need to get not just Sioux Falls, but other packing plants open from a food security and availability perspective, but also just from a producer perspective. As far as Smithfield, I mean, yeah, you read through the report as I did, as you did. You get the sense that there's, you know, nothing particularly onerous there. We're dealing with a 111-year-old building and processes that a lot of us are not particularly familiar with. And so you can think, oh, okay, well, I read here they put up a ton of plexiglass, but some additional plexiglass is going to be necessary before reopening. Well, there's some areas where they're using hot water. And if you have too much plexiglass, that can trap the hot water in place, which may steam up the area. And when you have people using sharp instruments, visibility is important. So that's something that when you're reading the report just on its face, maybe you don't appreciate. Things like making sure there are, hand dryers, touchless hand dryers. Well, that may put a strain on an electrical system that was put in long ago, and that may take additional time. So the report itself doesn't seem very onerous, but it is going to take some real effort on behalf of Smithfield and others to make sure that thing gets open in a way that's consistent with public health.
Is it possible they don't open it? Is it possible that it's not worth the investment to Smithfield? And what happens then?
Well, this is a really important part of the American food system. Depending on how you count it, it's anywhere from 4% to 6% of our nation's pork capabilities, capacity. It's the second, I believe, as I look at the numbers, it's Smithfield's second largest plant in the entire country. So it's important to all of us who like to eat. It's important to Smithfield. It's important to Sioux Falls. It's important to the workers. It's important to the producers. It is really hard to imagine that thing not sticking around. I know at times John Morrell had talked about closing it, but that was under a very different environment. The capacity, it's a lot tighter capacity in that packing industry, which causes lots of problems for producers, I would mention as an aside. But if we want to continue to feed America and the rest of the world, I think that is a critically important part of the equation. And there are not a ton of new plants being built. So if they're going to start closing old plants, although this one is very old, I just don't think they have the appetite to start shuttering plants when this country needs them.
All right. So what happens next? And start with the producers first. Are producers really going to have to figure out how to destroy thousands of hogs? Is that going to happen in the next 2 weeks? Is it going to happen in the coming weeks? Is it happening now? Yeah.
It is, yeah. And I talked to producers or members of Congress who had talked to producers just over the weekend in both Minnesota and Iowa that had some relatively widespread depopulation, and it's not good. I mean, it is not good for 100 different reasons. And I think if the plant has to stay offline for very much longer, it is an inevitability. I mean, we just don't have the capacity in this country when we have, I mean, it's not just Smithfield at 20,000 hogs a day. It's 100,000 hogs a day nationally that we're down off of capacity, and it is going to have a devastating impact. But that being said, we want to, when it comes back online, we want it to be safe. We should be measuring twice and cutting once.
Where do they put the carcasses of hogs when they're destroyed? How are we solving some of those massive problems? And how are the farmers going to, you know, handle the trauma of that? Because you used to take them to a plant where there were, I mean, regardless of how you feel about a processing plant, there were systems in place for the humanity of the treatment of the animals. And now that regulatory, I mean, the door's wide open.
Yeah, that I think is a very astute comment, and people probably don't realize over the last 30 years the evolution that really has happened in these processing plants and animal. I mean, there is just a lot more from an animal treatment perspective that is being done than was being done. And, it, you know, by and large, when there's depopulations on the farm, there are trenches dug and then the carcasses are thrown in the trench. It takes the digging of the trench. That's not the really time consuming part. I mean, it really is putting down the animals, which has an emotional toll when people are raising that to be food. I mean, they're raising that animal to provide life to another family somewhere else. When that isn't the end result, that is a double whammy.
Yeah. All right. So what do you think the federal government can do? What are the steps that you're calling for in Congress?
Yeah, so Senator Thune and I led a 5- or 6-state letter here last week. Lots of interest from our colleagues in getting on this letter. And we've tried to be national leaders in calling out for months as we've looked at coronavirus and trying to figure out what are the impacts on ag producers specifically. And so whether it's Roger Marshall from Kansas and I leading letters and efforts, or Senator Thune and I, we really tried to be focused. I mean, Senator Tom Tillis and I had done something, previously. But what we're calling for, number one, we do need assistance to producers so that they can pay their bills like so many other Americans and small businesses. Things like the Paycheck Protection did help, but they're a unique set of financial burdens in ag country we need to be attentive to. We secured $23 billion in the CARES Act. We need to get that money out in the country. It has not been released yet. We've been talking to USDA a lot. We need to make sure that if there needs to be flexibility on things like hours of service for truck drivers so that we can get these animals moved around to places where there is capacity, that we don't have government standing in the way there. We need to make sure that USDA, when they're doing inspections, because this is a heavily inspected industry, we want to make sure that there's not a packing plant that's got to hit the pause button because there's not an inspector at the right place at the right time. Let's make sure that we're not slowing things down at the federal government level. And, let's make sure that to the extent these producers have massive out-of-pocket expenses, Lori, on this euthanizing that we're talking about, that the federal government is willing to walk with them, partner with them on some of those extraordinary costs. And I think we're moving toward making that happen.
Congressman Johnson, you also called for the federal government to acknowledge and support local media. And, you know, we've had lots of struggles with small town newspapers in South Dakota. Speak for a moment, if you would, about the importance of, you know, this is the biggest story, community story in South Dakota history, perhaps, with the impact that we're seeing. And yet some of these newspapers are having a hard time covering it because they just don't have the revenue is completely dried up as well. What's at stake here?
Yeah, and I, like many, you know, thoughtful Americans for a decade have felt bad about where news has been headed from a financial perspective. And I know everybody loves to pick on the media, and in the politician playbook, you know, which I don't read closely enough, it probably says that I'm just supposed to spend all of my time when we talk about the media railing against, you know, the indignities of dealing with them when they're so biased. Well, the reality is you can't have a free country without a free media. And there are times where that is a massive pain in my butt. But if I want a free country, that's the cost of doing business. And they will write things that politicians don't like, and they will say things that politicians don't like. And that is not a flaw in the system. That is a necessary characteristic of the system. That's what brings the freedom, is that tension, that accountability. I know my three sons behave themselves a lot better when they know that there's a chance their mother or I could walk in the room in the next couple of minutes. And we all, I'm not being hard on politicians, we all are better at our jobs and in being humans when we know that we will be held accountable for wrongdoing. And when we don't have the cop on the beat, when we don't have smart people with the tools to ask serious questions, then we risk having a government that is not as good at its job. And that's as true for the weekly newspaper as it is for CBS Evening News. And the weekly newspaper and the small local radio, I mean, these guys are getting pummeled. And I don't know what to do about it. But I do know that all of us as citizens, to the extent that we want a better, you know, more verdant world, that's got to be something that, to the greatest extent we can, we should invest in. I mean, we should invest in institutions that make us better. We should invest in news organizations that make us better. And I don't have a lot, as many friends who take a newspaper subscription as used to, and I just wish they would. Now, there's a role for the federal government to play. That's what our letter was about. But this is a bigger problem. This is a problem that the federal government cannot solve on its own. It is for all thoughtful, well-intentioned Americans to ask themselves, what kind of media do they want to invest in?
Governor Kristi Noem this week had unveiled her Back to Normal plan. Do we fully understand the governor's plan? On Wednesday, we invited the Dakota Political Junkies onto the program to answer this question and more. Enjoy.
We're joined today by Dakota Political Junkies. We've got John Schaff. He is with us from Aberdeen, where he's a professor of political science at Northern State University. Welcome back, John.
Good to be here.
Also with us, Tom Dempster. He served District 9 in the South Dakota State Senate for four terms. Tom, thanks for the time today.
Good afternoon, Lori.
I'm going to start with the Back to Normal plan, and we're going to play a little audio clip from when Governor Noem was talking with Sean Hannity about this plan. And let's take a listen, and then we'll talk a little bit about how this reads nationally and then what it really means here in the state.
In South Dakota, we didn't close any businesses. We didn't do any shelter in place. I trusted my people. They trusted me to make decisions that were best for us, and they've just done an absolute fantastic job. That's why my plan is not a reopening plan. It's a back to normal plan. We're working our way back towards getting the life in South Dakota that we love again, and I'm giving them guidance to do that.
All right, that's the message that the nation is hearing about South Dakota in South Dakota. It's pretty much the same message, but clearly nuanced because we know that 28,000 people have filed for unemployment, and it's not quite as if there were a lot of businesses that did close, even though they didn't have to. John Schaff, as you look at this plan, what stands out to you about the governor's message? And now she's announced there's no press conference today. What are some of your initial thoughts about this plan?
Well, precisely, sort of going on what the governor told Sean Hannity last night. If I could give the governor's staff, it's too late now, a nickel's worth of free advice, is I think the back to normal plan was probably a bit of a misnomer. Because for one thing, the governor's right about this, from the point of view of state policy, in a lot of ways, not a lot is changing. So there's nothing to go back from because the state was relatively hands-off. But I think what you get nationally sometimes, and the governor alluded to this a bit on Hannity last night, but it could be misleading. You know, there's a reason why I'm talking to you on the phone from my basement instead of at the Tom and Daniel Amen studio at Northern State University. So I'm not allowed in that room. There's a reason that my kids aren't allowed to play on public playground equipment in Avering, which is wrapped in police tape. As you say, all those people have filed for unemployment. So it's not like South Dakota is doing nothing. But it is true. What I take with the governor and watching the governor's press conference yesterday, I think what she's saying is that the state is changing its advice to being relatively severe advice of being extremely careful. And while it's true there was never a shelter-at-home order, we were advised to shelter at home. That was the advice given. And what the governor is saying is most South Dakotans have followed this advice and we have done well. And the advice now is changing that maybe you can gather in small groups. Businesses can open as long as there aren't too many people in the business and they're prudent in how they go about doing disinfecting and this sort of thing. And that's what I'm getting from the governor is she's trying to signal to the people of South Dakota, maybe loosen up a little bit as you go about what has been a very restricted daily routine. Maybe that daily routine can expand somewhat. And so it's not really back to normal. It's just back to less weird is how I would describe it.
Oh, if only we had called it the back to less weird plan.
We would have had. That would not have been my advice, but I didn't wordsmith that before I uttered it. So, but something along those lines.
It's going to stick now, John. You never know. Somebody's going to tweet it out. Tom Dempster, your thoughts on the governor's initiative and really the message that the nation is getting and the message that South Dakotans are getting and why that matters, what message the nation gets.
Some time ago, on my way to the airport in Maui, in Hawaii, I came upon a surfing beach. And I've never seen waves like that in my life. And I've never seen people surf like that in my life. I mean, it was absolutely incredible. And I cannot imagine the thrill at being atop one of those waves. That's one of the problems, in my opinion, that you have when all of a sudden the national media finds a star. And starts paying attention to you. Peggy Noonan in the Wall Street Journal in her column probably, three or four weeks ago, notably about Governor Walsom, I think, in California, Governor of New York, talked about these governors now becoming instant celebrities. And she gave an admonition and said, don't let this turn your head. Don't let this, all of this newfound attention give you so much confidence that you, well, like the surfer in Maui, all of a sudden find a wave that you cannot catch and tumble hard. I think the governor has done a good job in terms of a focused message. She's done a good job in terms of consistently telling people the truth and to stay out of harm's way. But all of this attention that you get on a national basis can create some hubris. That I think can ultimately detract from a capacity to do a job well in South Dakota.
How, I'm wondering, does the narrative have to include tourist season, the impacts of being open for tourist season, and perhaps even continuing to go on with planning for fireworks over Mount Rushmore on the 4th of July, because we're looking at coming up on May 1st, and John, do you think that there is a connection to what we're saying in the nation to who we want to invite to the state in the days ahead? And is Tom right? Is that riding on top of a wave that we might regret being on top of?
Well, it depends on how this plays out, because one of the things I think we're finding is, for example, I was one of the people who, you know, around spring break time about 5-6 weeks ago, when we saw people being quite foolish in Florida, thought that Florida was going to be a complete disaster, and it hasn't really worked out that way. Of course, it hasn't been a picnic, but it hasn't been the disaster people have thought. And one of the things we're seeing now is, if, for example, they've reopened beaches in Florida, is that being outside is one of the best things you can do. One thing just for your general health and your own immune system, of course, is strengthened by being outside in the sun. But also it's very hard to transmit the virus outdoors. And, of course, Mount Rushmore is outdoors. Now, what is that going to do? So some of the tourism that happens in the state really could go on with very limited problems. But some things, you know, when people start going to shops, when they start going to some of the tourist attractions, which are inside in very close quarters, I can think of the mobs I've been through at Reptile Garden with my kids, and I don't think that's something I want to do in this day and age. We'll see how those come about and whether those are the kinds of things that reopen, because I think people walking around our state parks or doing the walking path around Mount Rushmore is probably relatively safe. It's just in all those secondary things, and that's probably really more so what drives our tourist business, drives the tourist dollars, because most of the walking around is free. What really impacts the state economically is when people go into Keystone and they buy their T-shirt, you know, that sort of thing. And whether people are going to be doing that or not, I think, is the big question.
If we have fireworks at the 4th of July, though, there's not a lot of room to walk around because that's thousands
and
thousands
of
people.
It's a question of whether people are there. If there are people there, where are they and how tight are they together? Because then you look at the pictures, the overhead pictures, say, of beaches in Florida, and people are doing a pretty good job of spacing themselves. Of course, at Mount Rushmore, you've got the amphitheater. It's not wide open. I know how people are going to go about this and where you're going to watch from, I think, would be the question. So there's not – obviously, fireworks themselves are not a problem. They can do what they want. It's a matter of how do people congregate in order to view those fireworks, because we don't light off fireworks just for the sake of fireworks. They're there for viewing. So how do people go about that viewing?
Yeah. And you mentioned photographs. I was looking at some analysis of how photos are taken. If you take a picture from a different angle, it kind of looks like people are crowded. And if you take it from another angle, they're really actually standing far apart. So there's certainly, messages that are trying to be sent with the way people position their cameras and tell this story. Tom, anything about the 4th of July and sort of what it symbolizes to have, because this has been, since Governor Kristi Noem became governor, asking President Trump to bring them back. There's this, whole controversy about the environmental impact, which has now been resolved in a report that says, we can go forward with this. We've got the pandemic. We've got South Dakota. There's just a lot that's feeding into this coming date. What are your thoughts for us to look for when we go forward? We're also in an election year, and fireworks over Mount Rushmore that President Trump brought back for the 4th of July says something pretty epic, doesn't it?
Well, there's nothing more I think there are a few things even throughout the world that are more recognizable than Mount Rushmore. And it would be quite something to, as a candidate for anything, it would be quite something to pose oneself in that position as fireworks are exploding over Mount Rushmore. It's a national park. I'm going to guess any president would have that prerogative to do that. But we already have a template that demonstrates how you can do that successfully, and I think that was in South Sioux City this weekend. Is you can do all of that. You can have your car races, especially in an open state. But probably shouldn't have any participants there and go ahead and display.
I want to make sure that we also talk about some news that we shouldn't lose track of. And we'll start with you, John Schaaf, and that is when we go back to veto day with the South Dakota State Legislature, there were some accusations made against Senators Langer and Greenfield about consumption of alcohol. A committee investigated that, and we haven't talked about it yet. So give us a little overview, John, of what was revealed during that investigation.
Well, you know, last week there was an investigative committee meeting of the South Dakota Senate, and the two senators, Langer and Greenfield, were there virtually, as were most of the senators were there virtually. Only a small handful of people were actually in peer, including our former Attorney General, Marty Jackley, who was serving as defense counsel, you might say, for the accused. And what I got out of that is one thing, there seemed to be some bad blood between the House and Senate sides. Certainly got that. And there was a bit of a who's on first routine about timelines, about what time things happened, and then exactly how long was the House waiting for the Senate to do his job, and how much of that was because the accusation that Senators Greenfield and Langer, who are the two leaders of the South Dakota Senate, were intoxicated. That's the accusation. The upshot was that, you know, right at the beginning, both the senators basically admitted that they had been drinking, not on Capitol grounds, but at a lobbyist house quite near the Capitol grounds, as I understand it. And so they may have been, in some extent, under the influence. Mr. Jackley made the point over and over that there was no blood test. There was no there's no proof that they were intoxicated, other than, you know, people's assumptions based on actions. But and then what ended up happening was the after all the testimony is the committee had an argument over, or a discussion, I should say, whether they should censure or admonish the senators, and they chose to admonish was the language of the resolution, which is slightly below censure. And so it just seems like it's sort of a black eye that probably Senators Greenfield and Langer made some extraordinarily bad choices. They admitted as much, and they admitted that they had been drinking, and which somewhat contradicts what Brock Greenfield told the Senate on the night of veto day when he said that no one had been imbibing. Well, that's not true, which he admitted. And so it just seems like it's kind of some bad behavior. And I think some of the discussions that's going to come out of this is a little bit about how the legislature polices itself. And Tom could probably speak to that more intelligent than I can, since he's been a legislator. But this practice of free drinks from lobbyists is now coming under scrutiny, it looks like. And you wonder if there's going to be some rule changes about not just drinking at the Capitol, but it being on the job under the influence, which if I did that as a state employee, I'm in big trouble. In fact, even with tenure, that is a fireable offense if I am on campus intoxicated, but apparently not if you are a member of the South Dakota legislature. So we'll see if some of that changes.
Tom, what happens going ahead? Because it's one of those news stories that a lot of South Dakotans are going to miss because of the news cycle that we're in. But lawmakers aren't going to forget about it at all come next session. What do you think the real consequences are going to be for Senator Langer and Senator Greenfield?
Well, I mean, stepping back, I mean, there's never anything wrong with "I did it, I'm sorry." That's probably always a good place to start. I was talking to a friend of mine, and he said, I judge my candidates, I judge my political officials on four characteristics. One, temperance, prudence, wisdom, and justice. And I told my friend, I said, oh my, you've been reading your Aristotle, haven't you? And so, sure, there was a lack of temperance, there was a lack of prudence, there was a lack of wisdom, and I suppose there will certainly be justice. Because it is the majority leader, because it is the president pro tem, both very significant positions, positions that you don't get for the asking. These are positions that you have to earn from your caucus. Because they are at the top of leadership, that means that they will both spend some time in purgatory. Both of them are certainly capable. Both of them are people that you would trust. They made a mistake. They're going to be in purgatory for a while. We'll see what happens this election, presuming that they run again, which I would hope that they would. But we'll certainly see what happens to the leadership elections. But for sure, they will spend some time in purgatory.
Tom, there's no rule against, drinking on the job in the state for state lawmakers. Should there be?
I would argue that that's a misnomer. I mean, that happens, but it happens very rarely. I mean, I've been around for a long time, and when I was a student in the 60s or in college in the 70s, you'd always hear stories about people riding their horses up the Capitol steps. Pierre is a much saner place, at least in my experience, being in the Senate for 8 years than what it was 20, 30 years ago. Yes, having been in leadership, there are occasions when you would have private conversations with your members and say, "Ooh, I think you were under the influence at this particular committee meeting or whatever, or even not a committee meeting, just be careful." You'd have those conversations in any kind of big group, in any kind of big group that you have. It's all about temperance, all about prudence, all about wisdom, all about justice. Sometimes you fall away from that.
Now that's the show for this week. Thank you for joining us. Again, if you're looking for an individual segment from our radio program, you can find all of our segments at listen.sdpb.org or by following the In the Moment Segments podcast. And if you have a story idea, send an email to inthemoment@sdpb.org. For Lori Walsh and Chris Loffrey, I'm Josh Heyer. Thank you for listening.